On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Brands like Gucci and Prada and Louis Vuitton carry price tags that would eat up most people's monthly paychecks. The ads tell you luxury-grade goods are worth it. But what if it's all a lie? Behind those Italian labels, those claims of old-world craftsmanship, is just a lot of glue and cheap labor in China. The profit margins make CEOs salivate, and consumers are left holding the bag at 10 times what it costs to manufacture. This hour, On Point, the devils who sell you Prada. First, can you relate to this story from a 30-something consultant in Boston who strolled into the Hermes store last Tuesday afternoon and emerged with just the purchase he'd been longing for? His name is Kong.
I was just in Honolulu and kind of walking the strip there and wandered into the Hermes store and tried on these flip-flops there and liked them, but they didn't have my right size, so they ordered them from some other store, I think the Beverly Hills store, but it got there after I'd left. So I'd been kind of thinking about it, you know, all during my vacation, so I just got back on Sunday, and I was like, well, there's an Hermes store in Boston. I'll see if they have them in stock, and they had my size, so I decided to buy them. So I've been waiting for 3 weeks for these flip-flops.
Yes, and just wait till you hear how much Kong shelled out for his Hermes flip-flops. But first, joining me from San Francisco is Dana Thomas. She is the Paris-based culture and fashion writer for Newsweek magazine and author of the new book, Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. Dana, how nice to have you with us. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
You dig deep into the dark side of the luxury industry. Explain to us how consumers of luxury goods are being taken for a very expensive ride.
Well, it's a question of marketing. It's a question of hype. It's a question of profits for shareholders. Today, luxury fashion companies are primarily owned by businessmen who, before they acquired or took over these businesses hostily, had no previous connection to the luxury fashion business or fashion in general. The most famous, of course, is Bernard Arnault, who owns Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy, which is a group of 50 brands, including Christian Dior, Givenchy, Celine, and Louis Vuitton. And he was a property developer before getting into the luxury fashion business. I like to joke that he still is a property developer, but today his companies are couture houses. And for them, they've applied their, I mean, it makes great sense. They've applied good business sense to a business that was not well run to begin with. When I started in covering luxury fashion or fashion in general back in the late 80s at the Washington Post, these companies did, you know, $15, $20, $30 million a year in business.
And now?
Now they do over $1 billion. So, and back then they were owned and run by the families or the heirs, and they were, you know, a niche business for a niche clientele. And today they are gigantic global corporations that sell to the middle market around the world. But it's about profits. And to understand the profit margin, I'll tell you a little story about when I went to a factory in China. It was a handbag factory in Guangzhou, and they produce handbags. Luxury handbags of brands who tell you or like to claim that they don't produce in China, by the way, brands that you know, brands that you carry. And I saw them making a very nice handbag there, not too much glue. They weren't using any glue. That's a sign of a good handbag versus a cheap handbag is the amount of glue. And so this one was, you know, they were sewing it on machines, but they were sewing it. And it cost about $100 to produce, which is a lot of money in China, the country where they produce things for pennies.
Mm-hmm.
And that evening, I got back to Hong Kong and was meeting friends for a drink in a bar in a department store, which is very Hong Kong, and went through the department store. And the first department was, of course, handbags, the easiest thing to sell. And so there was the handbag sitting up on the shelf, retailing for $1,200. In a two-hour drive, it had gone up in price $1,100.
So the markup is just out of this, out of sight. I mean,
out of sight.
Yeah.
And before, there used to be middlemen. There were wholesalers. Remember in the old days, you had your producer, you had your wholesaler, you had your retailer, and then everyone doubled the price along the way. And that made sense. Somebody had to make some money along the way.
And now all that's gone.
All that's gone. The businessmen brought all of that in-house. They often own the factories where they're producing. They often own the stores. Most of the time, they own the stores where they're selling. there aren't franchises either. And so most of the profit comes back to the company, and they spend 10 to 12% of their profits, or of not their profits, of their sales turnover in advertising to create the hype to make you want to buy so they can sell more, and around it goes.
So you mentioned your visit to this factory in China with the handbag on the assembly line, essentially. Does that mean
exactly
long gone is the old craftsman sitting in a European shop hand-stitching that Louis Vuitton handbag or those Gucci shoes?
It's disappearing rapidly. I'll tell you, you know, what was the young man's name? Wong Kong?
Kong.
Kong. He was right to go to Hermes. If you really want luxury goods and you want it, you know, quality and hand craftsmanship and a great value at a hefty price, of course, you go to Hermes. They still do have the workshops with the craftsmen sitting there making things by hand. And not only do they make them by hand, when you order a handbag at Hermes, for example, and you walk into the store to buy it, you don't walk out with a handbag. You walk out with a receipt, but you don't walk out with a handbag. Mm. And what they do is they ask you what leather you want, what color, what kind of hardware, if you want the seams turned in or out, what kind of lining, and they make it to your specifications. Mm. And one person works on it from beginning to end, and it's all made by hand.
So if Hermes is good, then who are the worst offenders? Who's bad?
Oh, I'm not allowed to say. That was part of the agreement for visiting the Chinese factory. But on top of it, it was an agreement just for me. It's an agreement for all the people who produce at the factory, because the factory owner doesn't want the competition to know who else he's producing. So he has brand A on floor one and brand B on floor two and brand C on floor three. And A, B, and C don't know that the other two are producing there. Mm. So it's a big secret. Mm. The whole thing's a secret.
Well, generally speaking, though, the villains of your book are these 35 leading luxury brands that control, I think you said, 60% of the global market. These are names we know well. Prada, Gucci, Giorgio Armani, Chanel. But you say the biggest name in big luxury is Louis Vuitton.
Absolutely.
And the rise of the chairman of that company is described in very Machiavellian terms by many people, how he has shaped the luxury industry. In what way?
The wolf in cashmere.
Yes. So what's been his stamp on the luxury industry?
Well, he's the one who turned it into a business. He's the one who saw... His name is Bernard Arnault, and the property developer from northern France. And he's the one who saw that there was great potential in these brands. And he acquired the first one, Christian Dior, at basically a fire sale that was being held by the French government back in the mid-80s. There was a big bankrupt textile company called Boussac, a long, you know, a big old company. And it had all sorts of different companies folded into it that were all doing terribly. And one of them was Christian Dior. And Bernard Arnault said, I will buy this and I will take care of these people and I won't fire anybody, because, of course, this was the socialist government. You can't fire anybody. The socialist government was selling the package. And then he got a hold of it and he divested the group of just about everything except Christian Dior. Hmm. And then he buffed up Christian Dior. He fired the old couturier who'd been there 25 years. And he... had them spend tons of money in advertising. He brought in young bad boy ready to wear designers who, you know, like John Galliano, who does S&M inspired clothes, put on $1 million fashion shows, and then put the focus on accessories. And the sales went through the roof, and the profits went through the roof, and the shareholders were happy. And Bernard Arnault is now the 7th richest man in the world.
And has that become sort of a model for other companies to follow?
It absolutely has become the model. If you look back now, next time you page through Vogue or Harper's Bazaar or Vanity Fair, any of the glossy magazines, look at the ads for these brands. And even though it may be a clothing company like Saint Laurent, Yves Saint Laurent, which started, you know, as a couture house, or Christian Dior, which started as a couture house, and they made clothes, the first thing you'll see in the ad is a handbag. The only thing you'll see in the actually that they want you to see is a handbag, because of the profit markup, because it's easy to sell, because you don't have leftovers, because there are no sizes, and these companies rely on those bags to make money, and somehow, for some reason, we're buying into it.
And why is that, Dana?
And well, that's why I've written my book. I want readers to read it and ask themselves, why are we buying into this? You know, in 2000, Coach did a study, Coach Handbags, or a leather company, and the average American woman bought 2 handbags a year. And by 2004, she was buying 4 handbags a year. Now, at that rate, I suspect we're now buying 7 new handbags a year. And what on earth are we doing with all these handbags? Are there going to be landfills filled with handbags in 20 years?
And
why are we buying into this?
And
I
more
don't
expensive
know.
Handbags, right? It's not just
and
that we're buying more.
And crazy expensive.
Right.
Crazy expensive.
How does the celebrity culture play into that, Dana? Seeing a famous star wearing the handbag that we just must have.
Well, that's very interesting. And I devote actually a whole chapter to it in the book because it's a much bigger piece of the game than you think it is. As one stylist in Hollywood told me, you know, you get an item on a celebrity at the Oscars on the red carpet, it's $1 million of free advertising. Mm. Because the stars are photographed like crazy. They also tell you, today I am wearing a Gucci dress, Jimmy Choo shoes, I have a Swarovski bag or an Armani tuxedo, and Harry Winston or Chopard jewels. And that is beamed out around the world too. And all the magazines today are running these pictures over and over and over again.
We're talking about how luxury lost its luster. I'd like to go back to Kong. He now is going to fess up about what he paid for those fancy rubber and mesh flip-flops from the Hermes store in downtown Boston.
$253 with tax. They're expensive enough to be taxed in Massachusetts. I think if you buy something under some amount of money, you don't have to pay tax. So yeah, they're up there.
Indeed they are, helping us understand a world where rubber flip-flops can fetch hundreds of dollars is Dana Thomas. She's Newsweek's fashion writer who is based in Paris and author of the new book, Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. Dana, he sounds so thrilled to be spending $253 for a pair of flip-flops. I guess you heard that quite often in the writing of your book.
Absolutely, and I would have guessed it would have been double. So, you know, did he get a deal? I don't know. But to walk out of Hermes with anything for $253 is pretty good. He shopped well.
Mm. You started to tell us before the break about the celebrity culture and how it's changed the face of the luxury industry. I was interested to read in your book the story of how this all started with Giorgio Armani back in the Oscars in, what I think it was, 1989 or 1988, I think, as my memory serves me. Tell us the story about how that all started.
Well, you know, back in the golden era of the Hollywood studios, there were costume departments, and the costume departments dressed the stars on screen and off. If you look at the old movies, you'll see gowns by Adrian or Helen Rose at MGM, or of course Edith Head, who did those Hitchcock movies and has a record 12 Oscars, and used to dress Grace Kelly so dreamily that we all still want to look like her. And then after the studios blew up. And collapsed, the studio system, they didn't blow up, but the studio system collapsed.
Yep.
Stars were sort of on their own, but they didn't have, you know, to dress so much for off screen because there weren't that many public events. But in the 80s, more and more award shows started happening, and the premieres became important again, and they had to dress, and they didn't have anyone to help them. And, you know, do we remember when Demi Moore showed up at the Oscars in black latex or black spandex bicycle shorts?
Right.
And
help.
So help. Yeah. And Sybil Shepherd, who wore orange high tops with her gown.
Mm-hmm.
So Giorgio Armani saw this and said, these people need help, and I'm going to help them, and I'm going to, you know, forge a relationship between Hollywood, where they're photographed all the time, and the company, and this will be good for our company too. And he hired this really terrific woman named Wanda McDaniel, who was a gossip writer at the LA Times, at Herald Examiner, or LA Herald Examiner, which doesn't exist anymore. And she went out and she just started knocking on doors and getting to dress people. And the first really high profile one was Michelle Pfeiffer, who went to the Oscars looking really terrific in Giorgio Armani. And everybody else said, we've got to do this too. She looks great, no effort. They dressed her and you know, you don't have to think about it. And so the next year, Armani dressed so many people that Women's Wear Daily called the Oscars, the Academy Awards, the Armani Awards. Mm. And everyone looked really smart and very chic. And all the other luxury fashion brands saw what happened, that everybody was making a big fuss over all these stars wearing Armani, Denzel Washington, Jodie Foster, everybody, that they went out there and opened offices and started dressing everyone too. And the magazines like In Style and Vogue and Harper's Bazaar started running photographs, IDing everything that everyone was wearing, and then suddenly it became this business unto its own. And the stars realized they had more power, and they started asking mm-hmm. if they could keep the clothes. Then they started asking for donations to charities. And now in the last couple of years, they started just having their agents negotiate fees. Hmm. And they go up to, you know, more than $100,000 to wear a particular item on the red carpet. None of this is said publicly. It's called red carpet revenue. And it's a big and quietly brewing scandal in Hollywood.
If you want me to wear your dress, you're going to pay me $100,000 and then probably give me the dress in addition.
Right. And jewels and shoes and mm-hmm. handbags and tuxedos and watches. You know, a top male actor, a nominee for an Oscar, went to Harry Winston, or had someone, his stylist, call Harry Winston the day before the Oscars and said, I would like to have a set of diamond studs to wear to the Oscars, but you'll have to give them to me afterwards. Mm-hmm. And Harry Winston, of course, said, we don't need to give anything to anybody. Mm-hmm. We're just fine. But sure enough, he showed up on the red carpet wearing somebody's studs mm-hmm. that he wound up keeping.
You talk about these stars, Dana Thomas, in your book Deluxe, changing the way we dress in many ways. But you also talk about how the luxury industry has, I think it was, quote, realigned our economic class system. How does that trickle down to the average person, what you've just been talking about? How does it realign our class system in this country and beyond?
Well, a funny little story that sort of puts it in perspective. Yesterday, we were outside the city at Mill Valley, where I did a little speaking engagement and then went and had dinner with some friends. And we walked through the town of Mill Valley, and there was this young boy selling lemonade at a stand. So I sent my daughter over to buy the lemonade for a quarter. And one of the little girls, who was the pal of the lemonade merchant, was standing there with a tiny little fake Louis Vuitton handbag over her shoulder. She was maybe 8 years old.
Right.
And I complimented on her. I said, what a great little handbag. She's like, oh, thank you. It's Louis Vuitton. I thought, oh, my God. You know, this girl's 8 years old.
Right.
And she knows. She knows already.
Mm-hmm.
It's realigned our class system in a way. You know, it's more democratic, which is, of course, what the luxury fashion barons said they wanted to do.
Democratizing luxury.
Democratizing luxury, making it more accessible. And, you know, that's terrific. That, you know, that's the way of America, and we're trying to make that the way of the world, that if you work hard and you achieve the meritocracy, you can have the same thing as kings and queens. Why not? But at the same time, they're not delivering what they say they're delivering.
Which is a quality product.
Which is a quality product, the best that money can buy. And, I mean, some are. Some certainly are. Like I said, Hermes still does. Chanel still does. Actually, Louis Vuitton still does in its way. If you want something made to order and you want it, you know, in this leather and that size, I saw an amazing, when I went on a tour of the Louis Vuitton factory, I saw them making a jewelry box that was about 1 foot wide, 1 foot high, you know, 1 foot square. That's a pretty big jewelry box for a travel box. Mm. And it was made of some gray silk skin, maybe python, trimmed in black. And there was no LVs on it anywhere. If you didn't know it was Louis Vuitton, you would have never known it was Louis Vuitton. So you can, you know, still have that. Mm. But you don't have to be, you can, it's realigned our class system, because it's about the logos now. And you're now saying, because I can carry this LV or this Prada or this Gucci, I belong to this group mm-hmm. of people. What does that say? I don't know yet. I'm still trying to figure it out. But I know that we want to be able to feel part of these groups, and we're buying into the marketing.
I want to go to the phones. Lots of callers want to join us here, Dana. Manoog is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Manoog. You're on the line.
Thank you.
Sure.
That's a wonderful program. And Dana,
yes.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Oh, you're welcome.
Dana, I had a question. You know, these companies, these names, are always warning us about these knockoffs that are stealing their name, using, as you would say, their logos and so on.
Yes.
But listening to you from the beginning of the program, I was wondering how much shrinkage there is now without that sort of hand craftsmanship and things that are coming out of China. Is there? What's the disparity now between the knockoffs and the quote-unquote real thing?
Hmm. Manoog, thank you. Dana?
Well, you know, the counterfeit business is just a gigantic, gigantic business in the world today. It accounts for 7% of all of our production in the world, $600 billion worth. And that, of course, includes everything from baby formula to Ferraris. Yes, they actually make counterfeit Ferraris now. But the largest segment, or one of the largest segments, is luxury fashion goods because they're easy to knock off.
Mm-hmm.
And they're even easier to sell. And why are they so easy to sell? Because the luxury fashion businesses have been advertising their own brands so much, the counterfeiters don't even need to advertise. The logos are out there. The demand is out there. They just put it out there, and it sells like crazy. Now, the companies fight it. Some fight it, some don't. Some throw up their hands. Some people in the business even take it as a compliment. Marc Jacobs said he would be, upset if people didn't. He told me he thought it was brilliant that people, that he was counterfeited, that he was copied. He said it was a compliment, and he said that he hoped everybody, that everything that they would do would be so good that people want to copy it. Patrizio Bertelli, the head of Prada, told me, or said at a conference, that he thought it was part of the fashion, the game of fashion, and that he would be worried too if their things weren't counterfeited. Hmm. But counterfeiting is really a dark and nefarious world. It's run by crime syndicates, a bit like the drug world. It involves human trafficking and smuggling. It raises money for it. The money goes to things like terrorism.
In fact, there was a report that counterfeiting shops, I think in South America, you reported in your book, funded the September 11th attacks.
It's believed that they did. There's a gigantic market called the Tri-Border Market that does $70 million worth of business every year in cash. Or not every year, I'm sorry, every day. $70 million every day in cash. Mm. And it's a counterfeit market. And the day on September 12th, 1,100 stands closed shop, and some of them were suspected to be run by or backed by Al-Qaeda. Mm.
Dana Thomas, hold on just a moment. I'd like to bring in another voice to this conversation. From Galesburg, Illinois, is Tim Kasser. He's professor of psychology at Knox College, and he's an authority on materialism. Tim, it's nice to have you with us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to our conversation, and I wonder if you could explain to us from your perspective as a professional, what is it about our human nature that puts us in such hot pursuit of expensive things we can't afford and don't really need?
Well, I think it's both human nature and culture, just to begin with. And I think culture has done a great job in the last 20 or 30 years of capitalizing on human nature and making a buck off of it. But I think one of the things about humans is that as a species, our survival a long time ago really depended upon our ability, first off, to be able to use tools, to use stuff, and to care about things. You know, we were smart enough to pick up a stick and throw it at the saber-toothed lion as it charged at us, and that helped us survive. And we were smart enough to be able to figure out how to wear clothes, for example, and be able to settle new places. And so, you know, part of our species survival is that we are tool users. We are a species that likes stuff compared to donkeys or elephants or hoary marmots or whatever.
But do we like more stuff now than we used to, Tim?
Well, see, I think that's where we start to get at what culture is about. So what culture has done, especially capitalism and consumerism, has been to use that human tendency to want stuff and to turn it into a system where a lot of people can make a lot of money. And that's where we have advertisements that are telling us that we'll be happy or successful or that our life is meaningful if we have the right stuff. And we have governments that are always trying to put economic growth at the forefront. And we have businesses which think that profit is the be-all and end-all instead of fine craftsmanship. So what we have here is a culture which is always encouraging us to form our identity around around consumption, around buying things, around making a lot of money so then we can buy things. And so the two work in concert to make us want all this stuff.
And so if with a culture based on consumption, as you say, from a very scientific level, as you have studied, what does the research show about materialism and its pursuit?
Well, I think one of the things that I want to mention is why people end up being materialistic. And there's two main sources of that. The first is that people will see the messages in their society, from the advertisements or from their parents or from their friends, and that helps them take on that value system that says, you know, what's important in life is to have stuff, is to have the right image, is to own the things that are going to make me popular. But there's also that sense of insecurity which drives materialism too, and a lot of times advertisements capitalize on that. You know, I mean, who is it that gets the girl in the ad, or who is it that gets the guy in the ad? It's the woman with the right clothes or the right perfume or the right handbag. And, you know, that plays on something about people. You know, it plays on an insecurity that we have and tries to say, okay, well, you know, you don't want to feel insecure. You want to get the guy. You want to be happy. Get the stuff. Get the Prada bag or get whatever it is.
Is it a cycle, this materialism that works through a culture? How does it evolve and change? Does it always get worse?
Well, I think that we're in such new territory that it's difficult for me to say exactly what's going to happen in the future. You know, 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago, we didn't have the internet and we didn't have global marketing and we didn't have celebrities who were happy to wear diamond studs for $100,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that right now the culture is positioned in a way which it has never been positioned before. All cultures beforehand always said that greed and caring about money was a sin or was a problem and had setups in order to keep that down. Our culture elevates it to the greatest good and keeps it as something which is in the forefront of people's mind.
And luxury goods are often marketed now as necessities as opposed to being something special perhaps we treat ourselves to every once in a while on a special occasion.
Absolutely, because what marketers are trying to do is to hook into people's sense of who they are, that I am Prada, I am Nike, which I know is in fashion, high fashion, but I am any of these brands. And to the extent that they succeed in getting people to believe in that message, then those companies are more likely to make a profit.
Tim Kasser joining us from Galesburg, Illinois, professor of psychology at Knox College, Galesburg, Illinois. Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it, professor. I know you deliberately chose, Dana, not to unpack the psychological underpinnings of all of this, but what did you want readers to understand about what luxury represents?
Well, what I want, my inspiration, I had two inspirations for this book, and both of them, you know, come through. The first one was the book Fast Food Nation. Do you remember that book came out
sure.
a couple of years ago? And I read that book, and I turned to my husband, and I said, I want to write this book about the luxury fashion business. Meaning, I loved how he took the Big Mac, and he took it apart, and he told you what was in that bun, what was in the meat, how it got there, what it's going to do to you, and he didn't really analyze why we buy it, but he did take it apart. And I wanted to do the same thing for the luxury fashion business.
I'd like to get back to our luxury shopper. His name is Kong. He works as a consultant in downtown Boston. And he paid more than $250 for a pair of Hermes flip-flops. He says it's all worth it.
I guess I'm kind of the type of person for once I see something I kind of like and I can't afford it. It's not totally breaking the bank, you know, just like, well, why not? Every once in a while you want to go out and have a nice dinner and, you know, you get the check and you're like, oh, I didn't think it was going to be that much money. But you know, don't regret it afterwards, I don't think.
I'm joined now by Newsweek culture and fashion writer Dana Thomas. Her new book is Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. Dana, I'd like to go to the phone lines to invite our listeners in here. Eric is in Mystic, Connecticut. Hi, Eric. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Just from your last guest, the professor, talking about the psychology of this branding, and I just want to give an anecdotal story about my wife. She has about 120 or so Coach purses that she has been purchasing since college. And I used to always query her as to why she would want to spend, you know, $200-$300, sometimes up to $400 on just one single purse. And she used to always tout the quality of the bags in the earlier years. But she's noticed over the years that the Made in label has changed from Made in USA to Made in Mexico, and more recently in the past few years, Made in China. Hmm. And she's actually had problems with some of the bags in the past couple of years, and she's been upset about it. And she's evolved and transformed over the years from wanting it because of the quality, and then when the big logo syndrome happened and everybody had to have a logo and Coach started putting all the big C's on it, she, you know, fell in love with that. And then when all these counterfeiters started making it, she purposely does not buy the C's now, but she doesn't want anybody to ask her, is that real or not?
You know, I'm curious, when you said you asked your wife why she spends so much money on these bags, what was her answer?
She says that she feels like that she pays for good quality. That was her answer. And she's like, I believe that the bags are made well, and I don't mind spending money on something that's made well that I'm going to be able to keep for a long time. And I will admit that she's got purses that she took care of by, you know, buying the products to maintain the leather and everything that she had from college that mm-hmm. still look great. Mm-hmm.
Eric, thanks so much. Dana, I want to turn to you and ask you about the outsourcing of work on these products. Eric said that his wife noticed that the labels changed from Made in the United States to Made in China. How big of an issue is that?
Well, Coach is one of the companies who actually comes out and says that they manufacture in China, and they're quite proud of it. And they believe that they have maintained quality while outsourcing to developing nations. It sounds like the caller's wife would disagree with them. Coach also is now a 100% publicly traded company, and during this period when it was growing and it was moving to China, its stock shot up exponentially. 1,000%, I think it increased. Hmm. My husband's in banking. He said, why didn't you tell me about this when you saw this happening? And so there are, of course, when you're a publicly traded company, there are times when companies are forced to, in order to make those quarterly profit earnings, take short-term decisions that affect the long-term integrity of the company and its product. And sometimes that happens in production. One of the most amazing stories I came across was something very simple where a designer told me, you know, he worked for a company where they started cutting the jacket sleeves 1/4 inch shorter. And he said, now, you don't really notice 1/4 inch shorter on your arm, but when you're producing them by the thousands, when you get to 1,000, you start seeing the difference in cost. Mm. And so it's things like that, that maybe they're using a little bit more glue and less sewing. Mm. Maybe they're using a cheaper thread. I had a pair of Prada pants I bought. I'd been a Prada customer for 10 years. I had always liked their product, but I noticed that it was getting cheaper in quality. And buttons were starting to break when I sent them to the cleaners, and that had never happened before. Sweaters were coming unraveled after the third wearing. And then I bought a pair of pants for $800, mind you. Mm. And like our friend at Hermes, I was buying Prada originally because it was well made, and I thought that pair of $800 pants was going to last me a long time. It was a pair of navy blue pants, like the most classic you could buy, right? Mm. And I put them on, and my foot ripped out the hem. Then I put my hand in the pocket, and the pocket ripped away from the seam. Then I bent over to pick up my 2-year-old, and the back seam split open. Now, mind you, these pants did fit. This was not about me.
Right.
And I called a friend of mine at Prada, and I said, what's going on here? And he said, oh, to save money, they're using cheaper thread, and then the thread's so cheap, it breaks.
So it's all about the cost and not the workmanship anymore.
It's becoming increasingly
in many cases,
that, yes.
Yeah. Dana, let's go back to the phones. Eliza is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Eliza. You're on the air.
Hi, it's Allegra.
Oh, Allegra. I'm sorry. Hi.
That's okay. Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I know that a lot of my friends and a lot of people that I know have, you know, expensive purses or shoes or clothing, and I think that the ultimate goal for people, just humans in general, is to have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And they aspire to have big houses and all these big item things. And when others look at them, you know, they know that they've accomplished this goal if they have a nice purse or, like, $500 shoes on their feet. And I think that that's really important for some people, is for others to realize, it's really a self-esteem thing, just to say, oh, look, that person, you know, they have a Prada bag, they have a lot of money. And I think even if they don't have to say it right to them, I mean, I can be wearing a pair of sweatpants and a sweatshirt anywhere and have my Coach purse on me, and I feel like $1 million because people are looking at me saying, oh, yeah, well, she has a Coach purse. It makes my whole outfit just look you know, just a million times better.
Allegra, can I ask how old you are?
I'm 19 years old.
19. Thanks so much for your call. Roger is on the line from Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Roger. You're on the line.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Good. Go ahead with Dana Thomas.
I wanted to basically touch in. I love this subject, but out here, you know, there's a lot of these guys who will basically replicate or duplicate, if you will, the logo, especially Nike. I happen to know a lot of people who, you know, whatever you bring them, shirts, hats, shorts, they'll stamp a logo on it. And they, you know, they make an awful lot of money. Because I heard your expert earlier talking about, I am, you know, Nike, I am so-and-so and such and such. And it's huge. And it is a status symbol, especially in the, you know, communities where, you know, we typically can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Prada, you know, Gucci, you know, the mentality is basically who cares, you know, if it's real or not. I get to fly the actual logo.
Hmm.
And if I'm, you know, attitude is right, you know, and things like that, you know, I portray that image that the logo says. I personally wear a lot of Nike authentic, but I do know, you know, a lot of people who, you know,
who don't pay for it. Yeah.
Oh, I
Roger, no, I know. I hear you do, but some others don't. Thanks so much for your call, Roger. And one more, Lisa from Stowe, Vermont. Hi, Lisa. You're on the line.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to call to your attention a book that I read on the referral of a friend called The Essence of Style by a woman named Joan de Gene. She writes about King Louis XIV of France and how he really was responsible for creating a lot of the beginnings of high fashion and cafes. Even the interest that he had in high fashion really led to the beginning of magazines where they would put pictures or engraving pictures of countesses wearing the latest clothing and things like that to help promote the beginning of French fabric and French clothing making.
Mm. Well, thanks so much, Lisa. That reminds me, Dana, in your book, you talk about Napoleon and the flaunting of wealth by his wife, Josephine, which is
yes.
a very funny story. Would you tell it?
Well, Josephine... Well, there were several of them,
yeah.
the queens of France who spent a lot of money, but Josephine managed to spend half the amount of the Louisiana Purchase on clothes alone in 10 years.
Mm.
He originally sold the Louisiana Purchase to fund his wars, and they wound up funding her wardrobe.
Mm.
you know, we were talking about developing nations and what this does for the company, and you know, the perfect example of this is Valentino, the Italian luxury couture house, which just celebrated its 45th anniversary. It was sold a couple of years ago. It's been sold three times in the last 4 or 5 years, maybe 6 years. And they hadn't made a profit in about 30 years. And then in 2004, they began to outsource the production of their $1,300 men's suits in a factory in Cairo, where they were produced by veiled Muslim seamstresses who learned what they were doing by watching videos on televisions in the workshop. At the time, textile workers' hourly wages were $18.63 in Italy, and in Egypt, they were earning 88 cents an hour.
Mm.
And not surprisingly, 2 years later, Valentino was making a profit.
Mm.
It's a big difference.
Big difference, indeed. Let's go back to the phones. Elizabeth is now calling from Danvers, Massachusetts. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the line with Dana Thomas.
Hi.
Good. Thank you.
Well, I'm an antique vintage clothing dealer, and I'm totally upset with what's going on in the world outside. I've been in 35 years selling quilts, hooked rugs, and vintage clothing. I have a collection of calico prints from 19th century myself, about 150 dresses. They're all printed beautifully on roller printing from the 19th century, and even before that, I know about the 18th century, how they printed, you know, with blocks, and that's one of my things was to collect vintage clothing. I myself wear a Dolce & Gabbana bag, not because it's Dolce & Gabbana. I like the bag, and I found it in Chinatown. It had the label on it, but it was a reproduction. I don't know how they get away with it, but it's a dark green vinyl, and I keep getting comments on it, and I think it's a great bag.
Mm.
I paid $25. I don't feel embarrassed about it. I think what's going on is terrible. I think an 8-year-old child flaunting a Louis Vuitton is sending that child in the wrong direction. This is terrible. I grew up in New York City. I probably went to Lowman's a lot with my mother, who bought discount clothing that was really good. I know when it was coming out of Italy, I've seen it go to Indonesia, China, all over the world, because we're using other people. We're using slave labor. The quality is horrendous. I've sold to Donna Karan, Lauren, Calvin Klein, everybody. They mimic the fabrics. They mimic the styles. There's nothing new under the sun. Things revolve all the way around. Maybe some of them are doing good work, but what's coming out in Urban Outfitters, Archaeology, some Swedish company that has this big store, H&M or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right there on Fifth Avenue in New York City. Yeah.
It looks like gauze. It looks like basting stitches, and that these kids are going in there with their parents' money paying.
Yeah, they love it. They love it.
It falls apart.
Elizabeth, thank you. I'm going to get to some other calls. I appreciate your thoughts, though. Thanks so much. Suzanne is calling from Rockyville, Connecticut. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the line.
Well, hello, Jane, and hello, Dana.
Hi.
Hello. Just 3 points that I wanted to make, and it's about sort of a psychologist thing. First of all, you know, we live in a time of extremely sophisticated marketing. You brought someone on who talked about the psychology of that, but that's becoming more and more almost insidious with marketing. Then there's repetition. We hear things on television, through the internet, through red carpet, et cetera. So there's this bombarding. But the third point I wanted to make was something that I'm going to call delayed adolescence. When you're 12 years old or 19 years old, your self-esteem may be boosted by having a Coach bag or a Louis Vuitton. But how come when you're 30 and 40 and 50 years old, these things still have the same significance? I'm calling that delayed adolescence. Mm. We're not maturing the way that we used to. Therefore, the kinds of things that impressed us when we were much younger are still impressing us into our advanced ages.
Suzanne, thank you for your thoughts. I appreciate it. Dana, any thoughts about that?
I think that's very interesting, and I love that buzzword, delayed adolescence. I think it's very clever. I thought that what the caller said about counterfeiting was interesting, and my little 8-year-old girlfriend at the lemonade stand. One thing that most people don't know about counterfeiting is that it's produced in clandestine workshops in slum areas in China, and the workers are often underage. Mm-hmm. I went on a police raid with Chinese police in Guangzhou, and we went into the factory. And there before us were a group of 8 and 10-year-olds making fake Dunhill and Versace bags that were going to be shipped to America. And the owners were arrested, and the children were left homeless because the owners housed them in the slums. Mm. When we left, they threw bottles and cans at us because they saw the cops as the bad guys. Some of them even punched their time cards in hope of getting paid, not realizing that their company had been put out of business. Mm. So, that little handbag that little 8-year-old girl was wearing, chances are it was made by a child the same age as her in China.
Here's the question.
Hire children is because it's all clandestine, and they can't get real, of age workers because they've got, legitimate jobs.
Right. What's the future of all this luxury industry, Dana? Where do you think it's going?
Well, it's hard to say. I do believe that luxury itself is at a crossroads. You're going to have the super gigantic global corporations that are doing billions and billions of dollars a year in sales. Already today, Louis Vuitton does $3 billion worth of sales a year. Gucci was doing $2.5 billion, and they said they wanted to double their sales in 10 years or 7 years, and they're well on their way to doing it. Mm. And then you have what I call luxury refugees, which are smaller brands, often, or luxury rebels, people who got out of the business and who, out of the big giant corporations and have gone back to the roots of the business, what took them to it in the first place, and are doing small boutique brands where they might have one store, 2 stores, maybe no stores, maybe they just sell in department stores, or they have a little, a showroom and you can come and see them. And they're doing, beautiful goods and beautiful clothes, well, in beautiful materials. And they're not doing a lot. It's a limited production. They don't have leftovers that they have to put in outlets, and they don't, they aren't doing all different kinds of diffusion brands, underwear, makeup, skincare, homeware, blah, blah, blah. They just do one thing and they do it well. Mm. And so I think it's really, and they don't have logos, no logos. So I think there's really, you know, they're going to be continued big corporation rolling out to developing nations, emerging markets, as they call them, like China, India, and Russia. And then you're going to have a backlash in places like America, where people are going to start realizing that they're being taken for a ride, and they're going to go to the luxury refugees and get the real thing.
So I have about 20 seconds left, but I was wondering, after reading your book, where do you shop? What do you buy?
That's a good question. I have to say, actually, I shop at the outlets, and then, but I've actually kind of stopped shopping. I'm over the whole thing.
Simplifying. It's very good.
Simplifying. I'm wearing 15-year-old pants today.
Dana Thomas, the book is Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. I really enjoyed the book, and I appreciate you being with us today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.